I know not everyone is feeling the housing crunch right now. Some are making enough money to get by. Others bought at the right time with the right mortgage rate. For others, it's property taxes being held steady as their public schools are being well funded. But for many, the cost of housing is starting to encroach on the quality of life. So we're going to take this hour with an expert to explore the reasons of housing is becoming less and less affordable, the steps we can take to make it more affordable, and where the divide may be that is keeping us from getting there. You can join with your questions, your suggestions, your stories at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And our expert is Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at the UW-Madison. He teaches and researches affordable housing finance and policy at UW-Madison. And Kurt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
So let us start at the foundation here. And when I think of the foundation, I think of construction and some of the costs that go into construction that can make it so cost prohibitive.
Yeah. So in particular, we have seen a significant increase in construction costs in the last 6 years since the COVID pandemic. So for a comparison, inflation in the last 6 years has been up about 28%, but construction costs have been up 50%. So construction costs, that's everything that goes into building a home, and that's everything that is included, such as furnishings or appliances. So one way to think about the rise in housing costs is if the cost to build something new goes up, then the cost of existing housing also has to go up for that kind of share of value. So I've done research, and in Wisconsin, if we take Wisconsin on average over the state over the last 15 years, housing prices have gone up about 73%.
What?
But 89% of that increase is due to construction costs, and only 11% due to land.
Wow.
Right. So the way to think about it is, if you want to build a home, mm-hmm. you need four L's, we like to say. You need land, you need labor, you need lumber or materials, and you need lending or money. So we can break down each of those and how much those have gone up. But the biggest contributor to overall housing prices going up has been construction costs. Now, that was sorry if this is getting nerdy, but
no.
That rise in construction costs was layered upon an already existing undersupply of housing, particularly in higher demand job center counties. Right. So in
Wisconsin, but Kurt, I want to take a step back here and get back to construction costs, because when we're thinking about construction, we're thinking about the four L's: land, labor, lumber, lending. So, but really, we're looking at labor and lumber here when it comes to the increase in construction, right? And if that's the case,
right,
what's the increase that we find when we're looking at labor, and what's the increase when we think of lumber? When I say lumber, the first thing that comes to mind are tariffs and whether or not the international economy and our federal protections may be playing a part in this.
Right. So, in 2019, 1,000 board feet of lumber was about $200, and now it's about $600.
Oh.
Right. And so when you think about the hard cost to build a home, a single family home, about half of those hard costs are materials. And we say lumber, we also mean flooring and drywall and steel and concrete, and then half is labor. And so tariffs have certainly accelerated housing costs because they've accelerated construction costs, but it's also the significant shortfall in the supply chain for everything from garage door openers to appliances that we experienced during COVID.
Wow. So part of this is, these housing costs haven't gone up just starting with these tariffs. It predates that. But we look all the way back to what happened during COVID, some of the supply chain interruptions there, and we're still feeling the effects of that in our housing market.
Yes, absolutely. And then on the labor side,
yes,
particularly in our strongest demand counties, such as Dane or the Milwaukee suburbs, you actually have a shortage of labor in the construction and the various allied building trades. So one way to think about it is the total number of people employed in constructing buildings in Wisconsin. We finally got back to the 2006 peak just last year. So for a 15-year period, we had fewer people employed in construction. So that helps drive a scarcity premium for labor. So I like to say that even if I could wave a magic wand and we got the financing and the land in place to build housing, we simply do not have enough skilled and available workers in most parts of the state. And that especially impinges on rural areas because there might be only one or two home builders. And again, if you're in those trades, you would probably prefer to be in the Madison or Milwaukee metro area where wages are higher.
Kurt Paulson, our guest, professor of urban planning at the UW-Madison, who teaches and researches both affordable housing, finance, and policy. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk at WPR.org. So land prices have gone up, but not nearly with the same scope as labor and lumber. Lending prices have also gone up as well, Kurt.
Yes. Right. So if you think about lending, it affects home prices and rents two ways. So for a builder or a developer looking to build new housing, your construction loan is going to be 8, 9, or even 10%. Mm-hmm. And you have to recover that cost either in the rent or the sales price. And then for someone looking to buy a home, your cost of funds to buy the exact same house has almost doubled since 2021. So one way to think about it is, if you wanted to buy the exact same house in the year 2020 in Wisconsin to today, your monthly payment would be double. Part of that is due to the house value being more expensive. But a significant portion is that the mortgage is much more expensive. And so you said in the intro, there's people like me and probably a lot of your listeners who were able to refinance our mortgages in 2020 or 2021 at these really low rates. So that's another part of the kind of structural housing market, is just the number of units for sale is way down, right? Because people like me, we actually cannot afford to sell our house and move, even if a life event like a job or a death or a child, you know, aging out of the house would occur, because I mean, I have to be honest, my mortgage rate is now 2.8%.
Oh, you're bragging.
No, I feel bad about it.
Wait, right? You're lucky. I wouldn't feel bad.
You ask anyone in the state who refinanced their mortgage, and they will tell you they can't afford to move. So
yeah,
in the data, we see that Wisconsin has one of the highest percentages of existing mortgages with less than a 4% interest rate. And that's largely because we had a high home ownership rate prior to COVID. And we're an older state, so a lot of people are older and have owned their homes for a long time.
Sure.
And this means we're kind of stuck in place. Now, again, for me personally, it's good. But what it illustrates is that in a housing market, there's two sides to every equation.
Right.
Right? There's, for every seller, there's a buyer, and for every buyer, there's a seller. And so buyers want house prices to be lower, but sellers want house prices to be higher. And there's really no way to square that circle. What? So my own house has gone almost doubled in value since 2006. Now, I did nothing really to deserve that. But of course, that's primarily because I live in Dane County, where land prices have skyrocketed because of the strong job growth and strong demand. So I would want to say that this phenomenon is slightly different in different parts of the state, depending upon your land prices and job growth. So land prices have particularly accelerated in Dane County, the Madison area, and the Milwaukee suburbs, and also in Racine and Kenosha County, just because of the job growth. But land prices are not the big constraint in places like the Green Bay, Appleton area, Eau Claire, La Crosse. Their land prices are still relatively cheap. And so the high run-up in house prices is due to construction costs not land.
I had not considered the part of this equation that would be can't afford to sell. I understand the can't afford to buy angle, but from your perspective, Kurt, you explain it well, that part of the housing market is even if you had a life event or wanted to sell, that it economically it doesn't make a lot of sense with the way the market is. If you got in at a good interest rate, you'd be moving places just to pay a lot more in interest for your home.
Exactly. So yeah. I'm getting older now and the kids are out of the house, and maybe I'd like to move to a nice condo so I don't have to shovel or mow like a lot of people my age. But, you know, I'm sitting on a 4-bedroom house that I can't afford to sell because I'd have to move to someplace that is smaller
mm-hmm.
and would cost more per mm-hmm. month.
That makes
and
a lot
why,
of
sense. You know, I was going to say the normal churn of a housing market is people tend to either move up to bigger homes when they have small children and then move down to smaller homes when the children leave the house. But we have a large number of Gen X and baby boomers who are sitting on these large single family homes with only one or two people in the house. Now, they can afford it because either the mortgage is low or they've already paid off the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And so their only recurring costs are property taxes.
That makes a lot of sense. But property taxes are part of this equation. I want to get to some of the questions that are rolling in for you right now. Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. And you can join our conversation about the cost of housing, the affordability of selling. 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. And we'll start with Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hello, professor. So I'm wondering if you see Madison has a 20-year plan for vacant lands and how they are to be developed. They basically call out every home, every building, every square foot, other than picking out the color of the siding and and where the trees. Literally, it's very detailed. And I see thousands of acres of farm fields that could be developed that the city has already pre-planned out for 20 years, but they're not being developed. Is there a correlation at all between the builders not wanting to be restricted? And I don't see where there's any organic opportunity for a developer when the city's already basically dictated what it's got to look like.
Kurt?
Yeah, so I think the caller raises a lot of interesting questions. So if you think of cities like Madison or even Green Bay or La Crosse, if you want to build a lot of new housing, which we need to build, you can only do it one of two ways. Either you put it on new lands that are serviced where you extend roads, water, and sewer, or you try to do redevelopment or infill. And of course, there's different costs and benefits to each of those approaches. So in the case of a place like Madison and a lot of the surrounding communities, you may have a 20-year growth plan that shows a lot of areas designed for new housing. And I would say that in the Madison area, we've done a pretty good job of making those lands available at smaller lot sizes, a greater variety of housing types, such as townhouses or condos and multifamily. So it's not the kind of large lot suburban housing that you see in the Milwaukee suburbs. But the truth is just that if you're going to try to build, for example, a starter home in the Madison region or the Milwaukee region for like a teacher or a nurse, given land costs, you're going to look at building a starter home that's going to cost somewhere between $500,000 and $600,000. So it's not that developers don't want to build that. It's just that they are facing the same cost pressures and market demand, which is that not a lot of people can afford a new home at $500,000 or $600,000. So at least in the Madison region, we're building a lot of new housing. But just given construction costs, that new housing is pretty expensive. Now, if you go to the rest of the state and you wanted to build a starter home, the way I tell it to local officials is, imagine if I gave you the land for free, but then asked you to build a starter home, like 1,500 square feet, 3-bed, 2-bath. You're still looking at a cost to construct somewhere between $250,000 to $300,000, which again, is pretty expensive. And then if you add in the land costs, it makes it really out of reach for people. So even though we have a huge need for housing, and in many of the areas like Dane County, we are zoning to allow a lot of new housing, the market alone cannot provide housing at price points people want because construction costs are so high. But if you take the same issue in more rural counties, then the difference between what it costs to build new and what the price of existing housing is even bigger, which means that you're just not seeing a lot of development of housing unless you're going to use some variety of financial assistance from the state or the local government.
The market alone cannot provide. And it's sort of the takeaway there for me, Kurt, which, you know, when we start to get to solutions here, makes me wonder which direction we can go. But before that, Mike, thanks for the call about Dane County. Let's go next to St. Croix County, where David's calling from New Richmond. David, hi.
Hi. Say, I think one of the things driving up prices, too, is because a lot of older people have their places paid off, even though an interest rate right now to go out and finance something would be 6-7% somewhere in there. A lot of these places have gone up in value so much that they're, you know, people are able to sell them and literally get another better place now with the profits from the place that they just sold. So they're really not carrying a mortgage. So it makes the housing, the competition for the places even that much tighter, I think. And I think some kind of a great program that we need to develop, because I see so many people in Wisconsin who are elderly. If they could, we could have some program that they would, there would be families that would, we could figure out how to get young families connected with these elderly people and maybe cover some of their living costs. And then at the end of that, get into a house for a lot cheaper than what normally it would cost. I'm just throwing something out there, but I see a lot of single older people out there that I think could use some help. And
yeah. I've just seen this recently in my own neighborhood, David, with someone who is older, who is bringing in someone younger, who is then afforded the housing that would be otherwise unaffordable. And that certainly seems like a viable solution. But before we get to that, Kurt, I also wanted the other thing that David touched on was that there seems to be this, I don't want to say division of wealth, but this two-tier for folks who got in at the right time with the, you know, right interest rates that they can afford to shuffle around and maybe buy something else with their increased home value and don't even have to think about it, where the entry point for anybody who isn't in that home ownership place already is sort of left out no matter what, or at least by as the market wouldn't be able to do anything for them here.
Yeah, David brings up an excellent point that's also part of the challenge. So particularly for older homeowners who've accumulated a lot of equity, we're seeing this in housing around the state, both here in Dane County, but also St. Croix County, in the Minnesota suburbs that David's calling from, where people will sell their house and buy all in cash. So you could look at the data on the percent of home sales that are to first-time home buyers or to people who buy all in cash. And the numbers are way out of whack from a traditional market, because the median age of someone who buys a new home is about 40 years old. And most, you see a lot of home sales of people paying all cash. And so this also means that for younger people or first-time home buyers, you're really kind of unfairly competed against, because you might have a mortgage or a finance contingency or an inspection contingency. In a lot of our hot markets, people are buying in cash without a contingency. And so, again, if I'm a seller and I have two offers that are the same price, but one of them is a financed mortgage and the other is cash, I'm going to sell to the person with cash.
Every time.
It's just, it's easier. And so David's point is also well taken, that we have a lot of seniors who are sitting on larger homes, and perhaps they could take in a younger person as a renter, someone to help around the house. But the services we would need is that many seniors don't really want to become landlords. They don't have the inclination or the time to really find a renter. I know there are some companies that are trying to solve this with an app, something like, I think in the Bay Area, it's called PadShare. But those are interesting solutions that would help bring someone in. Another solution might be that a senior could build what we call a granny flat or an accessory dwelling unit.
Right.
Where they would still remain on the property, but then someone could take the main house, or the young person could rent this kind of smaller cottage in the backyard. So as David pointed out, there's a lot of creative solutions we need. But you're right that a lot of the disparity in the housing market is that you have generally older people sitting on a lot of equity. And until that kind of is processed through in the housing market, I don't see a lot of things changing. And there's just no incentive for someone to sell their home if there's nothing available to buy. So the possibility of renting a room or two to a younger family is certainly intriguing.
Kurt, there's one other aspect of home affordability I want to address. I've got about 3 minutes to get it done before we turn our attention to solutions. And that is what I saw from Realtor.com, that in the last 5 years, escrow costs have gone up about 45%. Part of that would have to do with the story of property taxes. Another part of that would have to do adequately funding public schools, which has had to be, which has been done, it seems, in Wisconsin increasingly through referenda, and the burden that can put on homeowners.
Right. So if you think about what you traditionally have to escrow for a mortgage, it's property taxes and insurance. So the other part of this story, I'll get to property taxes maybe after the break.
Okay.
But insurance costs have also skyrocketed for most homeowners. And that's largely due to construction costs. So if you have full replacement cost, if you look at your insurance policy carefully, you might see something called a inflation adjustment or an inflation rider. Because I pay my insurance company a premium. And basically the idea is if my house burned down, they would rebuild it exactly as it is. But exactly as it is about twice as expensive as when I bought it.
Sure.
So you have to pay more for your insurance just to rebuild the same house. Hmm. Plus, with all of the storm damage we've had around the country, and certainly here in Dane County, there's been a lot more loss. So one way to think about it is in 2011, I needed a new roof here in Dane County, and that new roof was $20,000. I just got hit by the most recent storm, so a new roof is about $35,000. So obviously insurance costs are going up for single-family homeowners, but also for landlords who have to pass that insurance cost increase into the rent that they charge. Right? So it's just kind of a cost squeeze everywhere in the system, and it's really putting a pressure on affordability. We used to say that you should budget about $1,000 a year for homeowners insurance in Wisconsin, but now it's much closer to about $2,000 a year, obviously depending upon how expensive your dwelling is.
Well, I think we have set up the problem quite nicely here, Kurt. I appreciate it. And we'll get to property taxes next. But then we turn our attention to solutions. And part of my takeaway there is that perhaps the market alone cannot provide for the steps that we would need to take, at least in larger communities towards affordable housing, that we have to address some of the shortages in housing. But that comes to some degree from the shortages in labor, that we have to try to find some way to have a continuous supply for construction, and that when we're looking at escrow costs, we're halfway through this part of the conversation, that has to do with insurance, and that has to go back to construction. You can see the dots beginning to connect for those who can't afford to buy today, can't afford to sell, and for many who can't even afford to rent. Kurt Paulson, our guest, professor of urban planning in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. You're welcome to this conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email us talk@WPR.org. And we'll be looking at solutions next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is WPR News. Where were we? Oh, yes, property taxes. It's the Lee Rayburn Show, and we're talking about affordable housing, or how we can make it affordable again, with our guest, Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. He teaches and researches both affordable housing finance and policy, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. But before we get back to our calls and emails, Kurt, let's talk about property taxes, because from my perspective, it feels like we can be pitting people on a fixed income with a home against public education funding and the future for our kids.
Exactly. So the other thing I teach is municipal finance. So okay. It's just kind of funny because all the controversial things. So the zoning and property taxes is what I earn my living doing. So one way to think about it is that there's an equation, which is revenues equals expenditures. If you want to maintain good quality public schools, if you want to fix the potholes, if you want public safety, if you want libraries and parks, all of these you have to pay for. And Wisconsin municipalities and school districts are heavily reliant on the property tax. And so, yes, that is a real struggle for people on fixed income. And there's really only two alternatives. You could, if you want to maintain the same level of public services, then you would need to find additional revenue sources from the state. And so that is either sales taxes or income taxes, or you'd have to raise property taxes, or the alternative is to let the schools get overcrowded or the potholes not get fixed.
But what we've seen recently, Kurt, is that communities have been, at least up to this point, largely willing to pass school referendums and agree to increase their own property taxes for the sake of public school funding. But there also seems to be perhaps a breaking point for some where they just can't cut it anymore. But what you're saying is, you know, we either reduce services or we find other avenues of revenue, and that would have to come from state income or state sales tax.
Right. So for school districts in the state, because that's the biggest property tax bill you pay, depending upon your tax base, up to 2/3 of the cost of providing public education is provided for by the state through the state equalization formula, which comes from sales and income taxes. But in terms of, you know, the per student state aid, it's been declining, adjusted for inflation. And that puts a real squeeze on schools. The other issue is, and this might get a little wonky, but if you need to build a new school or repair your old school, all of that money comes from the local property taxpayers. There's no state aid for what we call capital to build a new school. And so you have both a significant number of school districts doing these debt referendums to do either build a new school or expand or fix an old school. And then you also have operating referenda to just keep the lights on and the teachers paid. The other issue, of course, is across the state, there's significant disparities in the quality of the buildings that our students attend based on the tax base of the city. So again, in the Milwaukee suburbs, you might have new schools with all the bells and whistles. And then in the Milwaukee public school system, you might have really old buildings that don't even have air conditioning. So there's a lot of deep kind of structural issues about how we finance public services, but it all boils down to the property tax. And if I can go back to construction costs,
yes.
If I need to repair the roads, you know, the cost to repair a mile of road is about twice now what it was 10 years ago, just because of labor and materials all repeating the same story.
Well, yeah, but that goes into building new schools as well. But it also goes into, as you describe it, the disparity of opportunity in our public education system, largely dependent at this point on the property tax base and the communities in which these schools educate.
Yes, right. And so Wisconsin is better than many states in trying to reduce the disparity in per student expenditure or per pupil expenditure based on your tax base.
Okay.
Because about two-thirds of the school cost is supposed to be made up with this equalization formula. And if we really want to put your listeners to sleep, I will explain the school district equalization formula.
We will allow that. We'll do that next time, Kurt. I appreciate that. But
one of the biggest components of the state budget is state aid to school districts. So it's actually probably the most important thing to understand, but it's really wonky.
It's super complicated, but it seems to me that we could alleviate some of this from the property aspect if we push a little bit more on the income or sales aspect. Not that changes anything other than, you know, it alleviates this part of the discussion about the cost of living and the cost of putting a roof over your head, which is, you know, not an option. That is a kind of a necessity. You got to find a way to afford that before you can start looking at buying other things that would have sales taxes in it or affording other things from an income that would be taxed as well.
Yes, and I hear frequently from particularly senior homeowners, like in Milwaukee, where their income is fixed, but there's been significant property value growth. And so what might have been a $2,000 or $3,000 property tax bill is now a $5,000 or $6,000 property tax bill.
Oh.
And even though there are ways that you can borrow money to pay your property taxes, that really doesn't sound very popular at all for senior citizens who've worked all their life to afford and own a home.
Yeah.
So it's a particular challenge for those on a fixed income. And if you look at some of the programs we have at the state level, such as the Homestead Tax Credit, virtually nobody qualifies for those anymore because the funding has been reduced and the income qualification is well below what you would earn even on Social Security.
Which brings us to Elaine in Northeast Wisconsin. Let's go to her call now. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm having a problem with how much my assessed value went up from last year to this year. Last year it was $210,700, and this year it's up to $270,300. I have a call this afternoon to talk to the assessor to argue with this. I haven't done anything to the home for like 20, 25 years. It needs a lot of repair. If I had done the repairs, I could see why that went up, but I haven't done anything. And I want to know if it's worth arguing with him this afternoon when he calls. According to what I'm understanding, it's only went up because of the property values around this area.
Sounds like a case study for your class, Kurt. What would you suggest for Elaine?
Yes. So I want to first say that Elaine raises another question, which we might not have time to talk about, but it's a huge issue for particularly older people living in older housing, which is that the repair costs have really gone up. And so many people, they can barely afford the property taxes and the utilities and the insurance. So they let a lot of the repair costs go. So whether that's HVAC or a roof, they let it deteriorate. And so because we have a much older housing stock, we have a huge need for affordable finance for home repair, particularly for older homes. Now, with regard to Lane's question on the assessed value, so there's a couple of reasons why the assessed value would have gone up. It could be that the municipality had not reassessed properties for a couple of years, and they have to reassess properties every 5 years. The Wisconsin property tax assessment is based on the idea of fair market value. And so as Elaine points out, if all of the homes around you are selling for more, which is what we've talked about earlier in the program, then your house fair market value will also go up. So your assessed value has gone up not because you've made an improvement to the house, but because we assess at full market value in Wisconsin. So there might be idiosyncratic reasons why you could contest an assessment. But the other thing I'll say is just because your assessment went up does not mean your property taxes will go up. Because your property tax rate might go down based on whatever rate your school, city, and county choose. So what you pay in property taxes is your assessed value multiplied by your property tax rate. Given that local governments have some caps on what they can spend and raise, your assessed value might go up, but your property taxes might go down, depending on whether your assessed value went up at a higher rate than everyone else's in your city and county, if that makes any sense at all.
Should Elaine look to get her home reassessed? Would that help? But it sounds like even if an assessor comes to the home, it's still the houses around it that are making the lion's share of the difference here.
Yeah, I can't speak personally to her case because, I'm not certified as an appraiser.
Right.
But the Department of Revenue requires municipalities to use full value assessment. So if you look at your property tax bill, there's going to be an estimate from the Department of Revenue as to how much your house is worth. And the truth is, depending on where she's located, she probably could sell the house for $270,000. But here's the real problem. We don't think someone like Elaine should be forced to sell their house
right. Or
take out a loan
right. Just
to pay the property taxes. And so that's where, you know, we really need to think as a state about additional programs and assistance to help people stay in their homes, repair their homes, and afford the property taxes.
Elaine, I thank you for the call. I am sorry you're going through this, and I'm sure it is no reassurance to know that you are not alone. But thank you for sharing today, and I hope it helps others. So Let's Talk Solutions, Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, who teaches and researches both affordable housing finance and policy. So let's start with what you mentioned there, the possibility for subsidies for homeowners. But some would say that subsidies would just increase the cost anyway and gets baked into the ever-growing increase in what you pay.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. So, you know, to return to an earlier conversation, we need to build a lot more housing, particularly in areas where there's strong job growth, and that will help bring down housing prices overall. When we say the market alone is insufficient, what we mean is that for people of low or moderate income, they will experience significant relief on the prices, but it still might not be affordable to their income. So if we think about Elaine's question again, we have, you know, in the state, there was recently a $500 million legislative package for housing to build new housing. And of that, about $25 million was low interest or zero interest loans and grants for home repair. And those dollars went really quickly. So one thing I think we need to think about is a significant investment in home repair dollars, particularly for older homes, to maintain them and help maintain those kind of that operating expense that homeowners have. So relative to the kind of subsidies we're talking about, perhaps for property taxes, we do have a program, which is the Homestead Tax Credit, which has not really changed its formula since the 1990s. But again, if you subsidize people to buy homes, that subsidies tend to be reflected in higher home costs, as you pointed out. So when we talk about the solutions, they have to be on the supply side, building a lot more housing.
But
we also need to expand the housing safety net, particularly for the lowest income renters and senior citizens to help them afford
Kurt,
the housing. Yes.
That seems to be where the rub is, right? Because you can't afford to build affordable housing, that the cost of construction, the lumber and the labor is to a point now where it kind of it prices out any low or even moderate income folks who would be able to enter into the housing market. So where's the bridge in that gap as you see it?
Right. So the bridge in the gap is particularly for lowest income households is we have two main federal programs, one to build affordable homes, and that's the low-income housing tax credit. And that builds hundreds of thousands of units a year. And then the other is, of course, the housing voucher program, sometimes called Section 8. And that's on the rental side. on the home ownership side, we do have some down payment assistance programs and low down payment mortgages like FHA. But what we've seen nationally is that those affordable home ownership programs are severely underfunded.
Huh.
Right? And so it's really this question of, we can bring prices down a lot by building new houses, but if we want people to be able to actually afford those homes, we need to also be willing to subsidize, and that means increased public expenditure, which means, as you can guess, increased taxes. And so, you know, in the short run, we want to bring down the cost of building new housing, and there's not a lot of wiggle room on construction costs. There's some relief coming through some of the federal changes about modular and manufactured housing. We can lower the cost of housing by letting people build smaller homes on smaller lots, townhouses, condos, cottage clusters, multifamily. But unless we're willing to kind of tax ourselves to spend more to help build affordable housing, we're not going to see a lot of relief in the next 5 to 10 years, I'm sorry to say.
Kurt, I'm also hearing you say that there are programs in place to improve affordable housing, to make it more available for lower-income families, but those programs are either underfunded or ignored?
Well, they're underfunded. They're definitely not ignored. They are well-utilized. Right, so in Wisconsin, there's the state housing tax credit program and the federal housing tax credit program, which builds hundreds to thousands of low-income affordable rentals across the state, and that is a great program, but it's capped at the federal level. So it's,
Why is a state program being capped at the federal level? Why wouldn't this ability for us to move forward?
The state program is capped at the state level.
Okay.
But most of the state housing tax credit program is about $42 million in tax credit authority. And there's certainly been bills to double that or even triple that. But most new affordable homes are built with the low income housing tax credit, which again was recently increased at the federal level, but it's still capped based on a dollar of credits per population. So that's building the affordable rental homes. But there's really no mass federal or state program to build affordable home ownership opportunities, except, again, the state did pass a couple of years ago $500 million program, which is going to, over time, help a little bit on the cost of building new single-family homes, so reducing some of the infrastructure costs, reducing some of the construction costs. But again, you know, if you think of the four L's,
right,
we can make the land cheaper through zoning and smaller lot sizes. That has an effect more in expensive areas. We can make labor cheaper, which I don't think we can really do, and it's not really a good thing because we want people to be able to afford the homes
right.
to build.
We want them to have a living
wage. We have a
labor
shortage.
Right.
We can't do much on lumber and materials costs because those are determined federally, nationally, internationally, really. And so we can make the money cheaper by lending at low interest rates. A lot of cities are turning to tax increment financing to help make affordable housing projects pencil out to be financially feasible. So at some level, as a state, and particularly in many regions, we're kind of maximizing all the tools we have, but the tools aren't big enough. When I speak to local governments, we usually quickly turn to wanting the federal government to write a big check, which in the past they have, but I'm not holding out a lot of hope for this current Congress.
Well, let me ask you this, because Congress just passed the 21st Century Road to Housing
Act
by 358-32 margin. I think the only Wisconsin representative on Capitol Hill to vote against it was Senator Ron Johnson. Does this build a road to the 21st century for housing as you see it, Kurt?
So the short answer is it makes a number of procedural and regulatory reforms which taken collectively over time, if implemented properly, might bend the cost curve down a little bit. So I want to sound more enthusiastic than that sound. But the 21st Century Road to Housing Act does not appropriate a single new dollar for any program. Now, so if we think about one of the barriers to housing in particularly high-cost areas like the Milwaukee suburbs or Madison, the 21st Century Road to Housing Act tells the federal government to publish a best practices zoning guide and an incentive fund to municipalities to reduce lot sizes and to be more permissive of housing. And so will that work? You know, at the margin, maybe, but there's part of our challenge is if you already own your home and it's appreciated a lot in value, you also have a strong incentive not to allow a lot of new, smaller format housing that's more affordable to be built anywhere near you, right? So it's not only that you can't afford to sell your home, it's that you actually have an incentive not to let new housing be built near you because that might lower your property value.
Sure.
So we've never yet figured out a way to kind of either incentivize or force incumbent homeowners to allow more housing near them. And so, you know, what the bill does is good, but will it be a big enough stick or a big enough carrot to move the needle? I'm not really that optimistic. And that's why you do see across the country, you see states trying to really lean into these reforms to kind of incentivize or force local governments to accommodate more housing or a greater variety of housing. And as you can imagine, these have been quite politically contentious.
Well, politics certainly seems to play a role here, Kurt, that the policy that we develop at the local level with regulations, at the state level with opportunities or incentives, and at the federal level with things like tariffs, all are playing a role in whether or not we can afford our home.
Yes, but I would want to be very clear that the politics of housing does not seem to map very easily on kind of a left, right, blue, red kind of partisan spectrum. And you even see that in the bipartisan nature of the Wisconsin housing bills a few years ago and the most recent federal bills, because, you know, every legislator, whether they're urban or rural or suburban, whether they're in a conservative state or a liberal state or a purple state, this is the number one issue their constituents are asking them to afford, right? There's certain policies that might code left or right, but most of these policies are really kind of a strange bipartisan hybrid of incentives to produce more housing and then subsidies or expenditures to help people afford the housing. So maybe we'll get a grand bargain, but
this federal legislation does not look like it for the time being, or at least not big enough to make the biggest difference.
It's the biggest piece of housing legislation in a generation, and it's significantly bipartisan. So we want to celebrate that and kind of build on its success. But, you know, it's not the end game. You're not going to see the federal government forcing states or local governments to kind of override local zoning. And, you know, then when it comes time to pass the budget and increase expenditure for affordable housing or rental subsidies, you know, we've had a lot of political fights and arguments in the last 10 years about how those should be structured and how much we should spend on those.
Kurt, I want to thank you for your time this hour, but we are out of it. I really want to invite you back because certainly this is a problem that's not going anywhere, and I would imagine that there is more to discuss. In fact, I apologize to not getting to the calls and emails today, but Kurt, I hope we have this opportunity again, and thank you so much for your wisdom today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at the UW-Madison. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.